November 1998, Washington, D.C. Microsoft CEO Bill Gates looks ill at ease. He's on screen, sitting in a leather office chair. Spectators, reporters, government lawyers, and his own legal team have packed the courthouse to watch him on video. Every bench space is taken. In the tape, Gates adjusts his orange-brown tie nervously. He's about to face 3 days of questioning. A tape deposition led by a legal mastermind from the private sector who's joined the government's team. The video is being replayed at trial as evidence. Anything he says on the tape can and will be used against him and Microsoft. Prosecutor David Boies isn't going easy on him. Gates rocks back and forth in his chair and takes long pauses before responding, sometimes getting surly. And that plays right into Boies' strategy.
What's the question? Is it, you ask me about when I wrote this email, or what are you asking me about?
I'm asking you about January of 1996.
That month?
Yes, sir.
And what about it?
What non-Microsoft browsers were you concerned about in January of 1996?
I don't know what you mean, concerned.
What is it about the word concerned that you don't understand?
The audience emits a chuckle, and even Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson, known for being a tough guy, can't help but laugh. He's got a bit more leeway to roll his eyes as Gates quibbles because there's no jury present. Gates sounds like someone trying to cover up the truth by splitting hairs. Boies calmly but insistently bores into it with him, not moving on until they've beaten the point right into the ground. The back and forth is draining the whole courtroom's patience, and Judge Jackson's frustration with Gates is becoming obvious. The courtroom can see it in Jackson's shaking head, his eye rolls, his laughter. On top of all that, Jackson's already ruled against Microsoft last year. But as bad as Gates comes across, Jackson's starting to look biased against Microsoft. And that's a problem for Boies. A big one.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town. And there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. You're listening to The Browser Wars, Netscape versus Microsoft. Microsoft has outmaneuvered Netscape by bundling its browser Internet Explorer with its Windows operating systems and then giving the browser away. As its users defect, Netscape withers. But before Microsoft can celebrate, the federal government and 20 states file antitrust lawsuits against Microsoft. The government aims to show that Microsoft acted illegally in squelching competition. by using its monopoly on PC operating systems to drive Netscape out of business. Microsoft claims it's just hard-nosed business and is fighting back. You are listening to Episode 6. Even when they lose, they win. The lawsuit goes on for years because the stakes are high. This could bring down the software giant once and for all. And the televised drama of a smooth-talking lawyer facing off against a geeky billionaire leaves the nation riveted. The courthouse has the atmosphere of a huge sporting event. Dozens of reporters are covering the trial. It's front page news and often the lead story on broadcast TV newscasts. Some people hire line sitters, people to wait overnight outside the courthouse to hold a spot in the hopes of getting into the courtroom to witness all this in person. While Gates was forced to answer questions in his deposition, he refuses to take the stand. The government gets around Gates' refusal by showing videotape of his lengthy 1998 deposition in the courtroom. His obstinance garners laughter and harumphs of disbelief from the gallery. The TV audience is lapping it up. The juiciest parts are the back and forth between Gates and Boies in the tape deposition. Boies is confident he's got the hard evidence to nail Gates. He shows Gates an email that a Microsoft executive sent him back in 1997.
The sentence right before that says we need to continue our jihad next year. That's the way it ends. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm. Now, I see it doesn't say Microsoft.
Well, when it says we there, do you understand that means something other than Microsoft, sir?
It could mean Brad Chase's group.
Gates is parsing words here and looking to shift the blame. Brad Chase, a Microsoft vice president, oversaw the launch of both Windows 95 and Internet Explorer. Boies moves on to the flashiest part of the email.
Do you know what he means by jihad?
Yeah, I think he's referring to our vigorous efforts to make a superior product and to market that product.
Gates seems to have an explanation for everything, but his persnicketiness isn't currying favor. As the trial plods on, Microsoft executives are forced to take the stand. They admit they tried to outcompete Netscape, but they paint the competition as run-of-the-mill. Any company tries to best competitors, after all. Unfortunately for the software giant, there's an extensive paper trail, and Boies plans to follow it as far as he can. An email a Microsoft exec sent in December 1996 practically spells out the company's plan to bundle Internet Explorer and Windows to beat Netscape. An assistant district attorney reads it aloud. I do not believe we can win on our current path. Even if we get Internet Explorer totally competitive with Navigator, why would we be chosen? They have 80% of the market share. My conclusion is we have to leverage Windows more. We need something more. Windows integration. That pretty well sums up what Boies is trying to demonstrate, that the only way that Microsoft could win the browser war is to cheat, and Windows is their atomic bomb of choice. And then, Boies turns up the heat even more by calling on Netscape CEO Jim Barksdale to set the record straight. With his Louisianan drawl, he's already a far more charming witness than Gates. Barksdale puts the blame for Netscape's demise squarely on Microsoft. If Microsoft had not engaged in its anti-competitive practices, it is my belief, and was the expectation of Netscape, that Netscape would have been able to continue on its mid-1996 trajectory. That would mean stratospheric growth. Instead, Netscape cratered. Microsoft's lawyers strike back. Microsoft's lead lawyer, John Warden, a partner at the prestigious white-collar law firm Sullivan & Cromwell, tries to paint Barksdale as a sore loser.
So 100% blame for Netscape's demise is on Microsoft? There were no other factors?
Warden has a few other aces up his sleeve, too. He produces one of Netscape's strategy documents titled Project Rocket Launch Plan. Warden is interested in one line from the memo in particular. DOJ and court actions create opportunity for Netscape. He intends to prove that Netscape hoped legal troubles would be Microsoft's downfall. Warden approaches Barksdale on the witness stand.
Is this suit, in your mind, a key opportunity for Netscape's business? Not a key one, but this suit is a way of protecting an opportunity to keep the playing field open for internet software.
Barksdale is more forthright and at ease on the stand than Gates was in his deposition. He's a press darling, and Gates is the villain. The press gets surprisingly good access in the trial. Judge Jackson not only allows them to film in the courtroom, he's open to talking about the trial himself. To give insight into his decision-making process, Jackson grants a series of interviews to The New Yorker and The New York Times throughout the proceedings. Journalists come to speak with the judge in his chambers in between court sessions, getting updates on his views of the various players. The New Yorker's influential media reporter, Ken Auletta, has his tape recorder out and sits on the edge of his seat. Once-in-a-lifetime trials with huge stakes don't come around very often, and Auletta is a constant presence in the courtroom. Across from him, Judge Jackson relaxes back into his reflective mode.
It's important in this case that the public understand how the judge's mind was made up so that when I make my decision in the end, they know where it came from.
Auletta nods. He knows he's getting good material for his story.
These materials aren't yet public. Can you hold them off the record until a final decision is made?
Of course.
On November 5th, 1999, a year and a half after the government filed suit, Judge Jackson issues his findings. Microsoft's dominance in the personal computer operating systems market does constitute a monopoly. He says Microsoft acted to crush any threats to that monopoly. Jackson reads aloud his decision.
Microsoft's decision to tie Internet Explorer to Windows cannot truly be explained as an attempt to benefit consumers and improve the efficiency of the software market generally, but rather as a part of a larger campaign to quash innovation that threatened its monopoly position. Microsoft placed an oppressive thumb on the scale of competitive fortune, thereby effectively guaranteeing its continued dominance.
Even though Jackson issues the ruling after the stock markets have closed, investors anticipate the news. Microsoft's stock falls 14%. Janet Reno, the nation's attorney general who brought the charges against Microsoft, is pleased with the verdict. Usually awkward in manner and sometimes blunt to a fault, she can barely contain her glee at a press conference she gives after the ruling has come down.
This is a great day for American consumers. We are so pleased with the court's findings, for they fully support the department's view that this case is about protection of innovation, competition, and the consumer's right to choose the products they want.
In the coming months, those who follow the trial closest, reporters, lawyers, tech impresarios, will invariably conclude that Microsoft never took the case seriously. They did not settle outside of court early when they had the chance, nor did they prepare Gates for his deposition. The company failed at each turn to appreciate the gravity of the situation. They've paid for their blasé attitude by losing the case. Bill Gates walks out of the courtroom after the decision has been rendered and is pounced on by a scrum of reporters jostling for his reaction.
With today's verdict, what's going to happen to Microsoft? We believe we have a strong case on appeal.
Gates heads to his own nearby press conference to give his spin on the verdict.
You have to understand that Mr. Boies made it clear in the negotiations leading up to the case. He is really out to destroy Microsoft.
On June 7th, 2000, the court orders a breakup of Microsoft. The company will have to split into two separate units. One will produce the operating system, and the other will produce software components. Microsoft appeals, and the forced separation is temporarily put on ice. But soon, another unexpected opportunity
arises for Microsoft. With the trial over, the embargo is also over for the journalists who spoke to Judge Jackson throughout the ordeal. One by one, stories hit the front page of newspapers and news sites full of brash quotes from Judge Jackson lambasting Microsoft. The New Yorker's Ken Auletta is particularly pleased with how his story turned out. In his story, Jackson compares Microsoft's insistence on their innocence to the protestations of, quote, gangland killers. The best remedy for the company, Jackson tells Auletta, would actually be for Bill Gates to write a book report. What on? The life of Napoleon. The new issue of The New Yorker has just hit newsstands. Back at Microsoft headquarters, one of Gates' minions sheepishly leaves a copy of the magazine on his desk. In the middle of a meeting with his team, he decides he has to read it. He scans the story quickly for Jackson's quotes, landing on the Napoleon section.
Just listen to this. Because I think he has a Napoleonic complex of himself and his company, an arrogance that derives from power and unalloyed success, with no leavening hard experience, no reverses. This is outrageous.
The team murmurs in assent as Gates thunders on.
And listen to what he says about boys. He says he's never seen a lawyer as great as boys in court. He calls boys' examinations of our witnesses gems. Gems! Do you believe it?
Gates slams the magazine into his trash can and speed dials his lawyers. He can't stand this outright criticism. But maybe it can be used in Microsoft's favor. Jackson's denunciations sold a lot of papers and magazines, making a big splash. But they'll come back to haunt him, leaving Microsoft with the last word.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's ZOHO.ONE. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind.
Washington, D.C., February 2001. Microsoft is going to fight it out in the appeals process until it's exhausted every legal move, and its army of lawyers is far from calling it quits. Its appeal is now under consideration by a federal appeals court. 7 appeals court judges host the next round of the trial and question both sides harshly. But most ominous of all for the government's case is this. The appeals court judges do not like seeing Jackson's jabbering
throughout the trial. Judge David Tatel states it plainly.
I don't see how you can get around the fact that the words he chose did convey to the average person bias.
Most damning of all is Chief Judge Harry Edwards' assessment.
There are some who would say that it violates the whole oath of office. The system would be a sham if all judges went around doing this. The public has something at stake. It's the integrity of the system.
Jackson, whose courtroom is four floors below, is not present. He declines to comment. In June 2001, the seven judges rule that Judge Jackson was so biased, he must be recused from the case. In their decision, the judges write, "We hold that the actions of the trial judge seriously tainted the proceedings before the district court and called into question the integrity of the judicial process." Settlement talks between Microsoft and the Department of Justice restart, with the DOJ now under a more business-friendly Republican administration. By November 2002, the department agrees to a settlement more agreeable to Microsoft than breaking up the company. Under the settlement, Microsoft cannot force computer manufacturers to carry Microsoft products, and they must share information about their code with other software developers that depend on Windows software. They emerge from the case with their reputation damaged, but fully functioning. So, Microsoft loses the case, but only technically. In reality, it wins. Other than millions of dollars in legal bills, Microsoft continues with business as usual. The upshot? Microsoft stays whole. When Gates takes the stand in a final appeals hearing, he pontificates on the speed at which the tech world experiences upheaval.
10 years is a very long time in the software industry. 10 years ago, Windows was just beginning to become broadly successful. 10 years before that, the PC industry barely existed. Given the constantly accelerating pace of innovation, I expect we will see more changes in the computing landscape in the next 10 years than in any prior 10-year period.
He's right. Those changes are coming, and fast. Microsoft is no longer a dominant force in web browsing. Google Chrome holds those honors, with 63% of the market. But Microsoft still reigns supreme on personal computers and corporate networks. Nevertheless, a new crop of online companies has been rising up. Google and Amazon are on the move. Facebook is not far off, and Apple is the most successful of all. Still, Microsoft has never stopped chugging along, and today, it's the most valuable company in the world after surpassing Apple in November of 2018. The principals in the first browser wars go on to become major figures in Silicon Valley and American business generally. Mark Andreessen, the whiz kid with the brilliantly simple idea to make the World Wide Web a nice place to spend time, heads up a major venture capital firm. He plays kingmaker in the industry and later sits on the board of Facebook. He got his revenge on those who he believed stole Mosaic from him and remains a major player in the computer business. Jim Clark, the co-founder of Netscape with Andreessen, becomes involved in WebMD and helps to found and fund other digital ventures as well. He never has a success like he had with Netscape, but then again, successes like that don't come but once in a lifetime anyway. He, too, got his revenge. Eric Bina, who helped to code the original Mosaic, which kicked off the entire browser wars, never gets as sucked into the machinery of Silicon Valley as Andreessen. He now lives in Illinois with his family. Paul Allen retired from Microsoft thanks to a bout of Hodgkin's lymphoma in the mid-80s, but maintained his shares in the company. When Microsoft later goes public, he becomes a billionaire, a major philanthropist and investor. He also becomes a public figure in the Pacific Northwest thanks to his sports team ownership. He purchases the Portland Trailblazers of the NBA in 1988 and the Seattle Seahawks of the NFL 8 years later. But he never beats his cancer and dies in 2018 at the age of 65.
And Bill Gates? Well, Bill Gates becomes the world's richest man for a time before being eclipsed by another tech gazillionaire, Jeff Bezos. He remains involved with Microsoft, a company with more staying power than many of its software and especially online brethren. While Microsoft loses some ground in the aughts, by 2018, its stocks are back at record highs, its products as popular as ever. Gates transitions in the aughts out of being the company's primary decision maker, and by 2014 is no longer the majority stockholder. He pivots instead toward large-scale philanthropy, along with his wife. Together, they use the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to donate heavily to agricultural research, to battle hunger, and promote global health. Netscape? Well, Netscape is now just a historical footnote in the archives of the many companies come and gone that shaped the digital world and made it what it is today. But it is a major one, the spark that lit the web aflame. Andreessen's vision that people would begin to see the internet as something fun, accessible, and customizable has come true, and then some. Today, there are literally billions of websites, and the web is ubiquitous. The connective fabric of modern life, for better and for worse. In May 1995, before Microsoft had significantly invested in the internet, Gates sent a memo to his staff. In it, he wrote, "The internet is the most important single development to come along since the IBM PC was introduced in 1981. The internet is a tidal wave. It changes the rules. It is an incredible opportunity, as well as an incredible challenge." Well, Netscape surfed that tidal wave, then drowned when the waves came crashing down. We're all still riding in its wake. Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is Business Wars. Hope you enjoyed this episode. A quick note about the conversations that you've been hearing. We can't know exactly what was said in many cases, but this dialogue is based on our best research. I'm your host, David Brown. Adam Pennenberg wrote this story, edited by Emily Frost. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor, edited and produced by Jenny Lauer. Sound designed by Bay Area Sound. Our executive producer is Marshall Louie, created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect forever.